Okay, 1 Corinthians 9:24. Actually, I think we'll leave the door open if that's all right. Perhaps we could open that one as well, and fling the doors wide. I'm sorry if you're chilly over there. Just I know that whatever temperature you're on now, it will be considerably warmer in here in, well, a few minutes' time, let alone when I finish. Right, 9:24 then. he's so funny, isn't he? What a blessing it is he's on the staff, isn't it lovely? Have you ever been absolutely certain of something, that something was going to happen, and then it didn't happen? Like, you've been planning this fantastic holiday, and you go on it and it is really awful. You know, everything goes wrong or whatever. And I want to start with a question this evening, which is this. Do you think that that could happen as regards you and heaven? That you could be absolutely certain that you'll be in heaven, and then at the end of the day, it doesn't happen and you're not there? I want to start with a straw poll, if I may. I'm going to ask you a question and I'm going to ask you to vote yea or nay to the question. And the question is, can I now be certain of heaven? Okay, that's the question. Have a moment to think whether the answer to that question is yes or no. Don't know is not a category that this straw poll recognises. Can I now be certain of heaven? And you've got to make up your own mind. No good waiting to see how many other people vote and then deciding that must be the right one. Okay. Who thinks the answer to that is yes? Thank you. Put your hands down. Who thinks the answer to that is no? Thank you. The reason I ask that is because of the rather surprising verse 23. I don't know whether you noticed that as the cliffhanger from last time, but it is an interesting verse, isn't it? Paul's saying that he lives by the principle that we're looking at this morning of do everything because of the gospel. So he becomes like group after group, as we saw this morning, in order to win them. To the Jews, he became like a Jew in order to win the Jews. To the weak, he became like the weak in order to win the weak, and so on. And then in verse 23, he says he does all this, he does everything because of the gospel, so that, he says in 23, lots of people share in the blessings of the gospel and end up in heaven, which is what you expect him to say. And rather surprisingly, he says he does all this so that I may share in the blessings of the gospel and end up in heaven. Seems to be an element of doubt. He might not end up in heaven. In fact, look at the end of verse 27. Beat my body and make it my slave, so that after I preach to others, I myself will not be disqualified for the prize. And the whole of this passage leads up to verse 12 of chapter 10. So if you think you are standing firm, be careful that you don't fall, which seems to be aimed at exactly the person who thinks that they stand, a person certain of heaven in the last analysis, and it seems to try, or deliberately, to shake their confidence. You're certain? You think you stand? Watch out. So keep this question in mind, will you, as we look through this passage. And the way I've structured it is to see in this passage various examples. An example from Paul, an example from Israel, an example for us, and finally over the page, if I had a cheat, which I don't have, is there any spares? Over the page, an example for Corinth. So these four sections. First of all then, an example from Paul. Chapter 9, verses 24 to 27. Of course, we must be very careful whenever we try to jump from somebody in the Bible straight to us. You know, just because Paul did something, you know, that's an example and we ought to do it. Well, does it mean that we should? Is he actually an example? And we ought to be very wary about doing that kind of jump. But in this case, we are right to do it because of verse 1 of chapter 11, chapter 11, verse 1, which is where the whole of this big section of chapters 8, 9 and 10 is leading up to. And Paul actually says in verse 1 of chapter 11, follow my example as I follow the example of Christ. So in this case, all that Paul is saying in these chapters is leading up to that, follow my example. And that's why we should learn from Paul's example that we're looking at this morning. You know, that principle, do everything because of the gospel, is something that we would do well to have as the driving force in our lives. Paul is an excellent example for us in that. And Paul says, follow my example. So this morning's passage, and this passage we're going to look at now, is set before us as an example from Paul. And it's a passage, if we look at verses 24 and 25, for example, it's a passage about getting the prize. He puts it in 24. Do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run in such a way as to get the prize. Verse 25, it's a passage about getting a crown. Everyone who competes in the games go into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will last. But we do it to get a crown that will last forever. In verse 27, it's all about not being disqualified for a prize. No, I beat my body, I make it my slave, so that after I preach to others, I myself will not be disqualified for the prize. It's about getting the prize, getting the crown, not being disqualified. So Paul is here talking about our question, can I be certain about heaven? Which is what he means by the prize or the crown. And I want you to notice, first of all, what it is he says about this crown, this prize. The first thing he says is that the crown is future. Look at the way that Paul talks about the Christian life, about being a Christian. He uses the picture in verse 24 of a race in which we're running for a prize at the end of the race. In verse 25, he uses the idea of the athletic games, in which we're trying to get the winner's wreath, something ahead of us that we're trying to get. For both the runner and for the competitive athlete, the aim is to be the person on the rostrum with the big number one underneath it, to be the winner. To be there in the medal ceremony. And that medal ceremony comes after the race. So all the time that we're in the race, which is how 24 and 25 look at it, all the time we're in it, the prize, whatever, is in the future. The crown is future. I was hearing this week about somebody who went with her swimming club to be in a swimming gala. And she turned up for the 9-year-old butterfly race, and she was the only person in it. So she was given the trophy there and then. Now that's rare, of course, to turn up and just get the prize. Normally, if you turn up and you don't get the prize, you have to wait. It's in the future, you've got to run the race first. And that's the picture that Paul's giving here. We're running a race and the prize is future. The crown is future. And just to kind of underline that, Paul describes the crown at the end of 25 as one that will last forever. So he's spelling it out, just in case we get confused in the metaphors of race running and athletics. We're talking about heaven here, and that's future. So that's the first thing Paul says about it, that the crown is future. Then he also says that the crown is not certain. And that's the whole point, isn't it, about verses 24 and 25, that the winning of the prize is not certain before the race. The last bit of verse 24 actually spells this out. Run in such a way as to get the prize. Which means it's clearly possible to be running in this race and not getting the prize. The prize is not certain. And both of these things, that the crown is future and that the crown is not certain, is different from how we think. First of all, the crown is future, and how that is different from how we think. I mean, of course, to say heaven is future is all rather obvious, isn't it? But it's exactly how we think. But how about if I put it like this? That the essential nature of being a Christian is to do with something in the future. Now that is different from how we think, isn't it? Because we always will tend, I think, towards thinking that the essential nature of being a Christian is to do with something here and now. And we always tend to, I think, treat our Christian experience as if it's more wonderful than it really is. That's why we tend to fib or exaggerate, isn't it, with one another? You know, about how good our prayer life is. About how well our quiet times are going this morning. You know, in the Bible study, I read this great verse this morning. You know, I got really challenged by such and such. How easy we found it to invite somebody to the mission. We always want to kind of upgrade our present experience of being a Christian. Because actually we tend to think the crown is present, that this is it. When the reality, of course, is that our normal Christian experience, if we're honest for a moment, is that it's about pain and failure and a struggle to believe and a struggle with sin where we feel we're losing quite as much as we win in the battle with sin. No, you see, Paul wants to say the crown is future, different from how we think. And the crown is not certain. That's different from how we think too, because we will tend, I think, if we're Christians, to think that there's no doubt we'll end up in heaven. And of course there's a right assurance that we should have as Christians, and I don't want this talk to undermine that. But our tendency will tend to be to think that the crown is so certain for us as Christians that we find verses like this rather embarrassing. You know, the thought that Paul could be disqualified in verse 27, well, of course he'll get the prize, you know, silly Paul. And that's why we need to be told the crown is not certain. And it's for those reasons that the crown is future, that the crown is not certain, that Paul writes as he does here. He writes to say, I am making sure I am not disqualified, verse 27. And you, verse 24, should run in such a way as to get the prize. The example from Paul, you see, is verse 27. I beat my body. I make it my slave, just like he said back in verse 19. I make it my slave so that after I preach to others, I myself will not be disqualified for the prize. So he said in 19, although he's free, he makes himself a slave. And in verse 27, he's saying what is involved in doing that, in working out that principle in verses 20, 21 and 22, that principle we're looking at this morning, those situations of becoming like so-and-so in order to win so-and-so. He's making it clear in 27 what is involved in doing that, beating my body and making it my slave. And it's no easy matter to develop that kind of flexibility, no easy matter to scale the Berlin walls. His body had to be enslaved. It took rigid self-discipline. It's like the single-minded training of the Olympic athlete. 10 months of a strict program those athletes spent preparing for them. And Paul is saying that's the kind of lifestyle demanded of a Christian who wants to not be disqualified from heaven. You see, what Paul is doing is setting up this direct link, a direct link between the gospel-centered self-denial we're looking at this morning, that of verses 20, 21 and 22, which demands the most strenuous training, a direct link between that and finally getting the prize of heaven. Those two things are linked together in verse 27. The most strenuous training to be like 20, 21 and 22, so that I'm not disqualified. Now he's clearly not saying that, you know, if we behave sufficiently flexibly, as in verses 20, 21 and 22, well then that will mean you deserve heaven. He's not saying that. But he is saying that for him there's no other way to be a Christian. There's no other way for him to follow Jesus. There's no other way to share in the gospel's blessings than to die to self-interest, as we were looking at this morning. To give up all insistence on my rights, to abandon my rights, to strive to win as many as possible, to put the gospel first, to do everything because of the gospel. See, just think at for a moment, just as we began as Christians by dying to self-interest and embracing the gospel with every fibre of our being, so we carry on as Christians in exactly the same way, dying to self-interest and embracing the gospel with every fibre of our being. Self on the cross and Christ on the throne. Salvation being what matters above anything else. So that we do everything because of the gospel. The gospel central. So just imagine Linford Christie for a moment. He begins the 100 metres. He's off, you know, that kind of wobbling cheeks that you always see in the slow motion things. He's pounding down the track. And enormous muscles, kind of everything steaming straight towards you. And after about 50 metres he stops. Because he's noticed some rather nice window boxes along the edge of the track. And he goes to pick up a few petunias. That's a crazy picture, isn't it? Now that's what Paul's saying. As we began, so we continue. The real Christian continues as he started. Dying to self-interest. Embracing the gospel with every bit of himself. Not wandering off to pick petunias. Eyes always on the finishing tape. Everything focused on heaven stuffed full of people. And what verses 24 to 27 is underlining is the fact that to be gospel-centered like that is the only way to be a Christian. That seems to me as the example from Paul. And to be gospel-centered like that, like we were looking at this morning, is no easy thing. To be like Paul in verses 20 to 22 is no easy thing. To abandon what we think is our right in order that others are saved is no easy thing. It costs. Secondly, an example from Israel, chapter 10, and verses 1 to 11 of chapter 10. And verse 6 makes it clear that we should read this paragraph as an example. Look at verse 6. These things occurred as examples to keep us from setting our hearts on evil things as they did. Make it the point again in verse 11. These things happened to them as examples. They were written down as warnings for us. So what is the example from Israel? And this paragraph about Israel, chapter 10, verses 1 to 11, makes two points. The first one is this. Israel were like us. Verse 1. For I don't want you to be ignorant of the fact, brothers, that our forefathers were all under the cloud and that they all passed through the sea. They were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. They all ate the same spiritual food and drank the same spiritual drink. For they drank from the spiritual rock that accompanied them, and that rock was Christ. Now, there's a few strange things in that verse which may have occurred to you as we're going through it. Phrases like baptized into Moses and being baptized in the cloud and the sea. And talking about a rock that accompanied them. We're happy to say that God provided water from a rock, but a rock accompanying them. It sort of has this picture of, you know, I don't know, a rock with little feet. And it kind of... and it's ready to be struck again for the next bit of water to come out. And the stuff about baptism and spiritual food. And is it all about baptism and the Lord's Supper or what? I'm not going to look at it verse by verse because it's difficult. And I don't think it's central to actually what this paragraph is saying. The point is that Paul is saying Israel were like us. In that, first of all, they were delivered. That's what he's saying in verses 1 and 2. They were all under the cloud. They all passed the sea. They were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. And what it's simply saying is God brought them out of Egypt. How he delivered them was through Moses or in Moses. But mentioning the water of the sea and the cloud is kind of shorthand for saying God brought them out of Egypt. He delivered them. And the way they started out, that's why I think he uses the word baptized, because it's starting out sort of language. The way they started out was by God delivering them, exodusing them, redeeming them, to use Old Testament words for it. So Israel were like us, first of all, in that they were delivered, and secondly, they were like us in that they were sustained, verses 3 and 4. They all ate the same spiritual food and drank the same spiritual drink. For they drank from the spiritual rock that accompanied them, and that rock was Christ. And what these verses are saying is God provided food and drink for them while they're in the wilderness. They enjoyed God's provision just as they enjoyed his protection and his presence. So they were like us. They were delivered, they were sustained. And that's exactly our experience of God as Christians. We are delivered from sin. God has redeemed us. How God did it was through Christ or in Christ. But the way we started out as Christians, just as the way that Israel started out, was by God's deliverance. And we are sustained as Christians, just as Israel was. God has simply provided for us all we need to keep going as Christians. He's given us one another. He's given us given gifts to the church together. He's given us the Bible to rule us and nourish us. Now we are sustained by God. We are delivered by God, just as Israel were delivered and were sustained. We are like us. They were the people of God. For these are the things that define the people of God. That we're delivered by him, because without him delivering us, we couldn't be part of his people. And we're sustained by him, that we rely on him each day to keep us. And then in verse 5, having made it clear that we are like Israel, we hit this huge nevertheless. Israel were like us, 1 to 4. Nevertheless, verse 5, God was not pleased with most of them. Their bodies were scattered over the desert. Now these things occurred as examples to keep us from setting our hearts on evil things as they did. Do not be idolaters as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and got up to indulge in pagan revelry. We should not commit sexual immorality as some of them did. And in one day, 23,000 of them died. We should not test the Lord as some of them did and were killed by snakes. And do not grumble as some of them did and were killed by the destroying angel. See, after four verses, verses 1 to 4, of saying, they all did it, they all did it, they all did it, they all did it, nevertheless, when we get to verse 5, Paul says, but with most of them, God was not pleased. In fact, if you think about it, most is a little understated, to say the least. I mean, what we're talking about is all except two. It should be very shocking. It should really hit us, verse 5. All were delivered, All were sustained, and all bar two didn't get there. They didn't win the prize, or they were disqualified, to use the words from the end of chapter 9. You see, Paul is Israel is given to us by Paul as an example of a people who didn't do what Paul does in verses 24 to 27. Paul does 24 to 27, one example. Israel didn't do that. Verses 1 to 11 of chapter 10. He beat his body and made it his slave. Israel did not. They began the same, but, verse 5, Israel ended very differently. And so Paul goes on now to show how it was that Israel didn't enslave their bodies. What was it about Israel that meant that they were disqualified? And verses 7 to 10, each of those verses are kind of little cameos. They refer to four stories from Israel's past. And like all Old Testament stories, the message from Israel's past is the story. It's not some extra interpretation. Paul just reminds us of the story. He simply says, remember what happened when Israel were idolaters, verse 7? Remember what happened when Israel committed sexual immorality in verse 8? 23,000 of them died. Remember what happened when Israel tested the Lord, verse 9? Some of them were killed by snakes. Remember what happened when they grumbled, verse 10? Some of them were killed by the destroying angel. Do you remember? Don't be like them. Don't be like that. Or verse 6, don't set out your hearts on evil things as they did. Now it would be good to look at each of those four stories. And I put the references on the sheet if you'd like to do that. We're not going to do that now. If you were to do that, the thing to ask in each case was, what was it that they were doing wrong? How was it that they were setting their hearts on evil things, as verse 6 puts it? How was it that they failed to make their bodies their slave, as chapter 9, verse 27 puts it? As you read the story of the golden calf, which is the story of verse 7, where you think, oh, we wouldn't do that. But what about grumbling, verse 10? What about the sexual immorality of verse 8? It actually only began in that story just because they happened to fancy some outsiders. But Paul's point, you see, is not so much what they did wrong, and that's the reason why we're not going to look at each of those stories in detail now. That's not his point so much what they did wrong. It's rather this. They had very good reason to think they were in, but they were left out. They had verses 1 to 4 to believe that they were in. They were all da-da-dum, they were all da-da-dum, they were all da-da-dum, but all bar two were left out. The awful nature of God's judgment falling is chilling, isn't it? I mean, if you just add up the numbers in those four verses, it's about 50,000 people. But actually, that's only half the story, because as verse says, all but two of the whole of Israel die in the desert. To be disqualified is awesome. And the reason it's awful in this passage is because it falls on Israel. People like us, who thought they were in. So then two examples. The example of Paul, somebody who beats his body, rigorous self-discipline to do verses 20 to 22. Somebody who lives by the principle of doing everything because of the gospel. So others are one, and he's not disqualified. The first example. The second example, the example of Israel. Like us, the people of God, delivered, sustained by God. But verse 6, they set their hearts on evil things, and so all but two are left scattered in the desert. So then, thirdly, an example for us. An example from Paul, an example from Israel for us. And just in case we miss the point, verses 11 to 13 rub our noses in it. Paul tells us the example from Israel as an example for us. These things happen, verse 11, to them as examples, and were written down as warnings for us, on whom the fulfillment of the ages has come. So if you think you're standing firm, be careful that you don't fall. No temptation has seized you except what is common to man. And God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you are tempted, he will also provide a way out so that you can stand up under it. And I want to look at those three verses a bit more closely now, and say four things from them. The first thing to say is that we're at the end of history. And that comes from that very important little phrase at the end of verse 11, where he says, these things happened as examples, were written down as warnings for us, this is the phrase, on whom the fulfillment of the ages has come. And the point is this. All of God's great purposes since before
He made the world center on Jesus. His great plan is to exalt Jesus to the center of the world. That's what he promised to do. And that promise has begun to be fulfilled in the life of Jesus. That's what Paul means here, that all of history has been leading up to what God has done, is doing, will do in Jesus. The Jesus event, if you like, is the fulfillment of everything. And because we live after Jesus came to this earth, we live in the kind of last stretched out bit of history, where God is kind of stretching out the moment between Jesus' first coming and his second coming. And we live in that stretched out bit. We live right at the end of history. And this affects two things, according to this verse. First of all, it affects how we read the Old Testament. According to Paul, the Old Testament is written down for Christians. They're warnings for us. I don't know whether you know that book, How to Read the Bible for All It's Worth, but it says a very interesting thing, very striking thing in that, where it says, no Bible narrative was written about you. And whilst that is true, this verse says, yes, okay, it wasn't written about us, but it was written for us, not for the Jews. Very trendy in academic circles nowadays to refer to the Old Testament as the Jewish Bible. It ain't. It's the Christian's book. It's our book. That's one of the consequences of us being at the end of history, according to verse 11. That the Old Testament is written down for us. It belongs to us. And the second thing it affects is how we should live. Because we're at the end of history, we should live as Paul lived. Remember those two great things from verses 24 to 27. The crown is future, the crown is not certain. If only we could get that perspective, we'd live right. If only we could get this perspective of we're just in a stretched out bit of history. We're in the end. You know, this is it. This is the end. We don't know how long the end's going to go on for, but it is the end. If only we could get fully gripped by what the end of verse 11 says. We're people on whom the fulfillment of the ages has come. We'd live right if we had that perspective. We'd live as Paul lived. He got that perspective. That's why he lived as verses 20 to 22 spell out. We'd do everything because of the gospel if we had that perspective. So because we're at the end of history, we look back to the Old Testament and get warned. We look forward to heaven and get right priorities. Israel should warn us as we look back. Heaven should get us to realize what matters as we look forward. So we live at the end of history. Secondly, we think we stand. Beginning of verse 12. So if you think you are standing firm. And the point is that we do. We think we stand. Think back to our opening question. Can I be certain of heaven? I take those who voted yes to that to indicate those people think they stand. That's what the Corinthians thought. Remember Mr. Certain from chapter 8. He thought he was sound in doctrine. Remember, when we're looking at those verses, verses 4, 5 and 6 of chapter 8, we're seeing that they were mature, solid Christian theology. He thought he'd been godly in applying that. He'd taken those teachings and worked it out in terms of idol meat. He was certain he was right. He thought he was safe from the danger of falling, it appears from this verse. In fact, it also appears from the way that Paul, in verses 1 to 4, seems to be referring in kind of passing to baptism and the Lord's Supper, that there were some people in Corinth, perhaps some of the Mr. Certains again, who thought that they were dead safe as Christians because they'd been baptized and because they took the Lord's Supper. A kind of, you know, sacramental inoculation. Take enough sacramental jabs, including a weekly booster injection, and you'll be safe. You'll definitely go to heaven. And whether or not that's so, we do know that Mr. Certain had a fairly high opinion of himself. That he's sound in doctrine, that he's godly in application. Oh yeah, Mr. Certain thought he was standing firm. No chance he'd be disqualified. Couldn't say the same for Mr. Weak, of course. He's terribly shaky. But Mr. Certain, oh yeah. And I think there's a fair amount of arrogance around amongst us. We don't really think we fall. We're fairly confident about ourselves. Okay, we may mess with sin sometimes, but in the final analysis, we'll be in heaven. The more we think of ourselves as Mr. Well-taught, certain, the more we think we stand. So it's to Paul, to us, that Paul says, beware, verse 12. Be careful that you don't fall. Just so that we're in exactly no doubt at all what Paul means when he says, be careful that you don't fall, it's the same word as the word he uses in verse 8, where he says in one day 23,000 of them died or fell. That word there is the word he uses at the end of verse 12. You couldn't get the example across more strongly, could you? Paul is saying as blatantly as he can, using the same word, what happened to Israel in the desert is exactly what could happen in Corinth. A sort of, be careful God doesn't do a desert on you. And the more I thought about this, the more I realised that I don't believe this. You know, I read a verse that refers to people being swallowed up. A whole family being swallowed up, which is one of the things referred to in those four verses 7 to 10. And I think, well, that's for then, it's not for now. I read about a plague of snakes in verse 9, and I think God wouldn't send snakes in Cobham, would he? Now, why do I think that? It's not that I think God has changed. I still believe he's awesome. I still believe he's capable of sending snakes to Cobham. No, it's that I think I'm above it. God wouldn't do that to me, to us. He wouldn't do that to us. And you see, that shows just how much I think I'm standing. I think I'm standing. That's why I think God won't send snakes. He doesn't need to. Israel, yes. Me, my setting my heart on evil things, well, it's not really as bad as Israel. And I realise that I read this verse as a warning without any teeth at all. I don't think I'll fall. I'm so sure that I stand. So I read, if you think you're standing, be careful that you'll fall. And I think, yes, but I won't fall because I'm standing firm. And Paul says, if you think you're standing firm, be careful that you don't fall. And I say, yes, but I won't fall because I'm standing firm. Now, the whole reading of this passage is the kind of domestication of God. I don't know whether you know that bit in the Narnia stories. I think it's in the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, I think, where the children are with Mr. and Mrs. Beaver. And they're talking about Aslan. And they've heard kind of stuff about Aslan and think, you know, what a wonderful person Aslan must be. And for the first time, it slips into the conversation from Mr. Beaver that Aslan is a lion. And it's kind of a shock for the children. And one of the children says, oh, a lion. I didn't think he was a lion. Is he safe? To which the answer from Mr. Beaver is, safe? Safe? Who said anything about safe? Of course he's not safe. He's a lion. But he is good. So we're not going to read verse 13 yet. We're not going to go let ourselves run to the assurance of verse 13 too quickly. See, we want the cosy comfort of the log fire of verse 13, of that promise, before we've felt the raging storm of the Lord's anger against his own in these verses. We've got to face the teeth of this warning. 23,000 fell. This is a warning for us who think we stand. We should beware, according to verse 12, lest we fall, lest we be disqualified, lest we run and don't get the prize. Can you imagine Dick falling away? No, nor can I. But this verse is exactly about the person we think is standing firm. To think Dick is safe is to show we don't believe this verse. So will you get this? Will you let this verse hit you? This is a warning for you. You need to be warned because you think you are standing as a Christian. Beware that you are not like Israel. Follow the example of Paul. And fourth thing to say, and that is that God is faithful, and this is verse 13. No temptation has seized you except what is common to man. And God is faithful, he will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you are tempted, he will also provide a way out so that you can stand up under it. This is a lovely verse, isn't it? So well known and well loved. In fact, probably so well known and well loved that we don't know it at all. And we need to read it very carefully. Actually, we should want to read it if verse 12 has hit us as a warning, as it should. If verse 12 has hit us, has gone home, we'll be crying out for God. If I could fall, I need God. And verse 13 is a wonderful statement of God's character. He is faithful. That is the heart of verse 13. God is faithful. See that phrase right in the middle there. And this statement is the one answer to that nagging question you've had in your mind through this talk. But surely a real Christian can't fall away, can they? And to that, Paul says, God is faithful. Everything he says in this verse depends on that being true of God, hangs on his character. But before he says that, there's the first statement at the beginning of verse 13. And this is a statement to put us in our place. No temptation has seized you except what is common to man. In other words, you haven't had to face anything worse than things what other people have had to face. Or at least that is what it seems to say at the beginning of verse 13. But actually that little word at the end, common to man, is just simply human. No temptation has seized you except what is human, or belonging to man, or suited to man. And Paul may very well be saying at the beginning of verse 13, no temptation you face is beyond you. Or put it another way around, any temptation you face is one you could resist. So let's get it clear, if that's right, that's what the beginning of verse 13 is saying, you can't say after verse 12, after you read verse 12, that's it then, I've had it, I will fall, I'm bound to, so I'll give up now. Because the beginning of verse 13 says, well, you could always resist. How do I know? What basis do I have for saying that, well, I could always resist? And that, I think, is where the statement about God being faithful comes in. Any temptation you face is one you could resist. God is faithful. And what this means is, he will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. And when you're tempted, he will also provide a way out so that you can stand up under it. In other words, to say God is faithful means two things. First of all, it means he protects us. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. And I think what this is saying is that he's made it sure that we'll never face a temptation that is irresistible. He protects us from any temptations like that. So we can never say after we've sinned, I couldn't help myself. Or, the temptation was just too strong. Or, I tried, I really did, I tried as hard as I could. God is faithful, and so he protects us. If we say, I couldn't help myself, we're saying that this verse is a lie and God is not faithful. And secondly, to say God is faithful means that he provides for us, end of the verse. When you're tempted, he will also provide a way out so that you can stand up under it. In those temptations we do face, and what he provides is a way out, a way to resist temptations, a way to continue to stand and not to fall. Now what is this way out that God provides out of temptations? I don't know about you, but I immediately think of things like emergency exits and fire escape routes. In other words, here I am in a situation, terribly tempted by something, particularly alluring, and somehow God will suddenly make the temptation not appear attractive to me at all. I don't know, it'll disappear, or I'll turn round and see a beautiful view or something. In other words, what I think it means is that it'll cease to be a temptation. But that's not what the end of verse 13 says at all. It says that he'll make an exit so that you'll be able to endure. So we're told what the exit is like. It's not an escape hatch, it's a route for endurers. And that fits, doesn't it? If you think back to verses 24 to 27 of chapter 9, the example from Paul. It says Paul goes into strict training so that he's not disqualified. And in the beginning of chapter 10 says Israel didn't go into strict training and so they were disqualified. So, well, clearly Paul is telling us to go into strict training so we avoid disqualification. What's the way out that God provides? Well, it's the strict training of chapter 9 verses 24 to 27. And it fits with what comes next in verse 14, doesn't it? What's the way out that God provides for the Corinthians? Flee idolatry. Flee. That's the way out. The way out of temptation that God provides for us is our endurance. Let me say that again. The way out of temptation that God provides for us is our endurance. As I struggle and sweat to keep going as a Christian, God is being faithful and providing for me. You know, we think that if God is providing something, we'll be sitting back in a deck chair. But that's not the Bible's way. When God provides, we're enduring hardship. That vicar that I mentioned earlier, going to the north of England, 4 years with no friends, some fruit, not lots. An aggressive congregation with a very strong feeling against him, really up against it, doing everything because of the gospel. That's God providing for him, keeping him there. Actually, when you think about what else could it be? Why else would he carry on? God providing for us and us hard at work, just keeping our heads above water. Those are one and the same thing. So what verse 13 promises is not that we won't fall, it's a promise that we need not fall. So the warning of verse 12 is just as strong. If you think you're standing, be careful that you don't fall. God is faithful, so we need not fall. He will provide a way out so you can stand, continue to stand. I have a friend who was facing a particular moral temptation. He said that he prayed for God to get him out of it. He didn't quote this verse, but it was strongly implied in what he was saying. And to cut a long story short, basically he gave way to this temptation and temptation and sinned. And what he was saying afterwards was, well, really God was to blame. I prayed and God clearly didn't answer my prayer. And in fact, that person has ended up nowhere spiritually now. But the point here, you see, is that God is not to blame. He protects, he provides, I'm to blame. Finally, then, an example for Corinth. We looked at the example from Paul, an example from Israel, as an example for us. Verse 6, they're examples to keep us from setting our hearts on evil things. Verse 11, they're written down as examples for us on whom the fulfillment of the ages has come. But the us, of course, here is not really us in Cobham in 1994, but the us is those in Corinth in 55 AD. So although I've spoken about this passage as an example for us, really, first of all, it's an example for Corinth. And I want to end by looking at why this section is here and how it is that it fits into 1 Corinthians, and particularly the issue of idol meat. And I think the simplest way is to ask two questions. First question is, what is the temptation that Paul is thinking of in verse 13? And Paul's obviously making a more general theological statement in verse 13, but is there a particular thing in Corinth that he's got in mind, especially something which he could call a temptation for them? And I think the answer is fairly simple. Paul apparently thinks of Mr. Certain eating idol meat as part of a sacrificial feast in a pagan temple is playing with idolatry. It's directly parallel to verses 7 to 10. And in fact, verse 7 seems to make it explicit that Israel's idolatry that he's talking about has to do with sitting down, eating and drinking, and indulging in pagan revelry. Just as the Corinthians does, their eating and so on is playing with idolatry. Mr. Certain thought it was fine to do this. He was confident he was standing and there was no compromise involved. But Paul is saying to him, to Mr. Certain, beware, that's exactly like Israel. And if they don't stop playing with the idolatry, then the same consequence awaits them as Israel suffered. So it's clear that what Paul said back in chapter 8 about idol meat wasn't the end of the matter. And verse 14 following is going to come right back to the issue we started with right at the beginning this morning. And he's going to make it clear that this kind of idol meat is definitely out. They must stop. He didn't say that in chapter 8, though. He wanted to do something else first. He took their thinking about idol meat, you know, that it was okay, the bit we saw in verses 4 to 6 of chapter 8, and said, okay, let's run with this for a minute. Let's take your theology. Let's take the thinking you've got and go with that for a minute. Even if your theology were right, in verses 4 to 6, your theology has gone wrong if you're insisting as you are. You've lost your gospel heart. You've lost that principle of do everything because of the gospel. You insist on your rights and you've stopped caring about salvation. So what Paul does is gets right under their skin. He doesn't blast them with stop eating idol meat, as he's going to. First of all, he does these other things and gets them to see the big issue that they've lost the gospel from centre stage. And now he comes full circle. So in the temptation of verse 13 is in fact the issue of chapter 8. Their eating of idol meat is playing with idols. It's directly parallel to Israel in the desert. Beware is his urgent warning. And secondly, thinking about again about this as an example for Corinth, what is the way out that Paul is thinking of in verse 13? And the way out that he's thinking of is verse 14. Therefore, flee idolatry. Beware, says Paul, beware lest you fall, beware lest you're disqualified. Stop it now. Don't play with fire. Flee idolatry. And that's the thing that we're going to come on to look at tomorrow morning. But for now, as I close, let's just go back to that opening question for a moment. Can I now be certain of heaven? And let me say that I don't think that's the question Paul is answering. It's the question we want to keep asking, isn't it? And whenever there's a question box at a conference like this, there's always a question along the lines of, you know, can a real Christian fall away? Now, Paul isn't interested in those kind of titillating hypothetical conundrums, as we are. He just speaks straight to the person who thinks they're standing. In Corinthian terms, to Mr. Certain. To the person who's certain of heaven, for whatever reason, for good reasons, to us. And he says, beware. Paul, you see, had very good reason to think he was in. He had very good reason to feel certain. But he doesn't take it for granted. He works hard, very hard, like an athlete, to continue to live by the gospel. Israel had very good reason to think they were in. They'd been delivered and sustained by God, but they were presumptuous with God, and all their bodies were left scattered over the desert. He challenges the complacent, you see, the presumptuous, the certain, us. And says verse 12 to us, if you think you're standing, be careful that you don't fall. Let's pray, and then we'll go to our nitty-gritty goops. Sovereign Lord, forgive our unbelief about your awesomeness. Forgive those times when we've domesticated you and think that's what you did then, but you wouldn't do it now. Forgive our presumption. Forgive our pride. And we pray for one another, the people sitting either side of us, every person in this room, and we pray for each one of us who thinks we stand, and we pray for each other that we would not fall. For Jesus' sake, amen.